From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I served 12 years, 3 months, and 3 days in prison for murder I never committed. However, during that time, I was blessed in a lot of ways. And I was blessed with meeting a lot of individuals that strengthened me.
Prosecutors on trial. After a man is freed from death row, the men who put him there are prosecuted for railroading him. Also, 8 immigrants die of hypothermia as they attempt to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll look at whether tougher policies by the U.S. Border Patrol are endangering the lives of people trying to enter the United States. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic is expected to release 3 captured American soldiers through Cyprus later today as a gesture of goodwill, this according to a Greek government official. A foreign ministry spokesperson said if everything goes well, the release of the soldiers is expected today. He said the acting Cypriot president would fly to Belgrade via Athens on a plane provided by Greece and would then return to Nicosia with the 3 U.S. servicemen. Dismissing Milosevic's unilateral ceasefire with ethnic Albanian rebels, NATO bombed today in Kosovo and elsewhere in Yugoslavia, while conditions worsened at refugee camps outside the country's borders. Macedonia, meanwhile, emptied a border enclave where tens of thousands of Kosovo refugees had been trapped for days in squalid conditions. The country had lashed out at the United States and its NATO allies, blaming them for failing to anticipate the flood of refugees driven out of Kosovo by Serb forces enraged over the alliance air campaign. Meanwhile, thousands of Kosovar refugees have been taken from a Macedonia border camp where they'd been trapped for days. Macedonian officials work through the night to bust the refugees out of the camp at Blatia. But the UN is claiming that many people are missing after the transfers and that families are being split up and sent to different areas. In Cincinnati, a judge has approved a tentative $5 million settlement of a lawsuit charging that cancer patients were unknowingly subjected to military-sponsored radiation experiments in the 1960s and 70s. The families that filed the class-action lawsuit claimed high-dose radiation hastened the deaths and increased the suffering of patients, in effect making them casualties of the Cold War. The lawsuit, filed 5 years ago, alleged that terminally ill cancer patients treated at Cincinnati General Hospital between 1960 and 1971 were given full-body and partial-body doses of radiation so researchers could measure its effects. Only one of the patients survives. In Guatemala, forensic experts have discovered mass graves containing the remains of at least 40 villagers believed killed by army troops during the country's civil war, this according to a human rights group. The 3 graves were found during excavations over the past 2 weeks near Pentanaca, a former village in western Guatemala, according to the Association of Relatives of the Disappeared and Detained. The forensic team from the Roman Catholic Archdiocese Human Rights Office is expected to conclude its excavations later this week. Leopoldo Galtieri, the military dictator who led Argentina into the Falklands War with Britain, testified in court yesterday about his knowledge of baby kidnappings during the country's dirty war. Galtieri was called as a witness at a preliminary hearing of a widening judicial investigation into the disappearance of parents and the adoption of their babies during Argentina's 1976 to 1983 military dictatorship. The former general told a federal judge he had no recollection of the couple or child in question who disappeared in 1977 with many other suspected leftists during the Argentina dictatorship. In South Africa yesterday, a top apartheid army officer described in chilling detail how he authorized the 1986 slayings of 10 youths who were drugged and then blown to pieces with explosives. The former Special Forces commander of the South African National Defense Force told the Amnesty Committee of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission the killings were part of a larger plan to eliminate people threatening state security. He said police would identify the targets and the Special Forces unit helped to capture or to kill them. Long-distance phone giant MCI WorldCom is being sued for discrimination. According to the lawsuit, a man was blocked from using his calling card to make a long-distance call from South Central Los Angeles. It says after the man gave all the necessary identification, an MCI operator told him that South Central was considered a high-fraud area and blocked the call. The neighborhood is mostly Black and Latino. And finally, Missouri voters yesterday narrowly rejected a proposal to join 43 other states in allowing residents to arm themselves with concealed handguns, the nation's first popular vote on the issue. Opponents of the proposed law defeated the measure with 52% of the vote. "We won," said a jubilant director of the state legislation for handgun control, which saw the Missouri vote as a key showdown with its chief adversary, the National Rifle Association. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And I guess as every day of this new war in Yugoslavia keeps going, you wonder if some Yugoslavians aren't thinking or harking back to the days of Marshal Tito, when at least all of the nationalities within Yugoslavia managed to some degree to get along and maintain peace. But ever since the breakup of Yugoslavia and the fall of the socialist camp, you see nothing but warfare and ethnic cleansing, and now, of course, a new United States intervention.
And to say the least, this is a major intervention, and as one would expect with the massive NATO bombing of the entire area, we're starting to see mounting civilian casualties and hundreds of thousands of refugees. Juan, I thought it was interesting to note that the United States says it will accept thousands of refugees and take them to Guantanamo and Cuba. Now, that's interesting because a story we've both covered extensively over the years is Haiti. And we all know how horrendous the conditions were there for the Haitian boat people that were picked up as they were trying to flee the coup and ultimately brought to Guantanamo. And I'd like to see if the conditions for the Yugoslav refugees are going to be any better than they were for the Haitian refugees and those being held there because they were said to have HIV.
Not to mention that isn't the lease on Guantanamo expiring? As I recall, it was supposed to end in 99 years, and it was started in the early 1900s. So I think 1999 is the end of the lease, although we haven't heard much about it in the corporate press world. Not as much, certainly, as the end of the Panama Canal, of the U.S. presence in the Panama Canal. But I'm pretty sure that that lease on Guantanamo is up.
Well, we'll continue to investigate what happens with the refugees. In fact, the news director at Pacifica Network News, Dan Coughlin, was the first reporter to get onto Guantanamo when the refugees were brought there. He had to sue to see the conditions. And I wonder if it'll be the same for reporters today. I'm also concerned about NATO being desperate. We are coming up on the 50th anniversary at the end of the month of NATO, and a desperate organization, desperate to show its power and its strength, can do some pretty frightening things. Clearly, our listeners are concerned. We've been getting calls from around the country, and we thought we'd start today's show by just airing some of those phone calls.
This is Teresa Bontaine from Los Angeles, California, listening to KPFK, and we'd like you to know that the Los Angeles Peace Center Coalition is, in conjunction with IAC and many other groups, is having a demonstration this Saturday and every Saturday until the bombing stops at the Westwood Federal Building at 12 noon. We are also having a meeting at which we will be discussing future actions and other types of actions, as well as a possible teach-in on the war. Thank you for being there and for helping us all to get the word out.
This is Dan Silverberg. I live in Coloma, California, although I listen to you often in Fresno, and I listen to KPFA or KFCF. I think that you missed the depth of revulsion and frustration that people felt during the Bosnian conflict. The images of snipers using German rifles to kill people at 1,000 yards, and maybe even more particularly the aerial photos of the mass graves at Srebrenica after the lawful UN forces were incapable of stopping the Serb offensive, and it had a traumatic effect on a lot of people. And I think now what you're seeing is people are saying, well, we didn't do anything, nobody did anything when the Serbs were on the offensive in Bosnia, and they took what they wanted and they gave back a little bit and got what they really wanted to keep. And it's very clear that what they're trying to do in Kosovo is push everybody out, and then, yes, they'll make peace and they'll get northern Kosovo. So basically they use force and violence and murder anytime it suits their purposes, and the rest of us are supposed to sit on our hands and do what they call negotiate. Well, you know, you don't negotiate unless you have to. Milosevic doesn't feel that he has to negotiate, so he doesn't.
Name, Anna Berger, city, Independence, Missouri, next to Kansas City, station KKFI in Kansas City. My comment is with regard to the references on this morning's program about Kosovo and the Serbs. There was reference made to self-determination of nations. And I hunted back in my head and also called the library and verified that at least one point in our history we came out in favor of self-determination of nations by Woodrow Wilson. But there probably is, to my memory, not a 10-year period in any of our history that we considered of any importance, the self-determination of the nations of our own native people. So it's obvious that politics has the ability to overlook its own lapses of commitment in a very real way, and this applies to the present situation as well. The self-determination of nations sometimes gets all screwed up. And the reference to it in history was Woodrow Wilson. Thank you. Hope you can hit on that because it's highly related to the present situation. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Bob Miller. I'm calling from San Francisco. We actually got your number from KPFA in Berkeley in California. I am calling to mention a website called www.keepfaith, KEEPFAITH.com. It is actually the story of two older ladies, sisters, who are living and sending reports out about the bombing of Belgrade. It is told by, or was put together by Sylvia Miller, and I can give you her number, is 415-831-9630. She's actually a Yugoslav, half-Serbian, half-Croatian. She is an Italian heritage countess, and lived in Yugoslavia for her first 25 years. She's made this website, and it's being based on reports that are coming in from email and by telephone from an Ivanka Besovic Morelli and Olga, who one is a published writer and actual journalist over there. The other is a violin teacher. And so, again, it's www.keepfaith.com.
Those calls from listeners around the country, and we'll continue to play them. We've been getting dozens of calls. The number you can call to let us know what you're doing or what you think about what's happening in Yugoslavia. You can also talk about the bombing of Iraq that's happening at the same time. Our number is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. And Juan, I noticed in the front page of the Washington Post today, blame on Madeleine Albright, U.S. miscalculations traced to Albright. The piece talks about how, as the clouds of violence darkened over Kosovo throughout 1998, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright argued repeatedly that Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic would respond to the threat of force. That conviction underlay U.S. negotiating tactics last fall when Milosevic appeared to back down from a campaign of repression in the province of Kosovo under the threat of NATO bombing. It was a basic assumption driving the peace conference at Rambouillet, France, in February, when Albright and her colleagues expected Milosevic to accept a U.S. brokered deal rather than face a NATO bombardment. And it was reflected in the belief at the State Department that when airstrikes began, Milosevic would probably back down after a few visible targets were hit. Well, these miscalculations about the efficacy of the threat and a collective underestimation of Milosevic's defiance have led the U.S. and its allies into an air war in Europe that's produced some of the same negative consequences they said they were trying to head off.
Well, Amy, you know, as the saying goes, it's deja vu all over again, whether it's Vietnam or Iraq or now in Yugoslavia, the arrogance of our leaders not to understand that when you launch bombing campaigns against a country, it tends to unite all the people on the other end of the bombs.
That's right. And we will continue to cover this issue. But right now, we're going to look at issue within the confines of our country, the United States, and we're going to go to Illinois. Opening statements began yesterday in the trial of three former Illinois prosecutors and four sheriff's deputies charged with railroading an innocent man and sending him to death row for 10 years. Rolando Cruz was accused of killing a 10-year-old girl in 1983. But despite evidence that another man might have been the killer, prosecutors pressed on with the case against Cruz. Ultimately, he was put on death row, then freed after a campaign by religious leaders, law school deans, and journalists who were convinced he was innocent. The DuPage County prosecutors and the sheriff's deputies, known as the DuPage Seven, are charged with misconduct in the case, including conspiracy to obstruct justice, conspiracy to commit official misconduct. Juries twice convicted Cruz of killing Janine Nicarico, who was abducted from her home in a Chicago suburb, raped, and murdered. Then, during Cruz's third trial in 1995, a supervisor in the sheriff's department recanted his previous testimony and cast doubt on a cornerstone of the prosecution that Cruz had revealed incriminating details to detectives in a 1983 statement describing a vision or a dream he'd had about the crime. According to the police, in his recounting of the vision, Cruz had revealed details about the murder that were not known to the public. Prosecutors had used that as proof that he'd committed the murder. But Cruz has always denied telling police about the dream, and interestingly enough, at the time, the police did not write down his dream. Before we talk to people involved with the case, we wanted to bring you Rolando Cruz himself. He was speaking last November at a conference in Chicago on death penalty and the innocence. In fact, he was introducing Reuben Hurricane Carter. This is Rolando Cruz.
I served 12 years, 3 months, and 3 days in prison for murder I never committed. However, during that time, I was blessed in a lot of ways. And I was blessed with meeting a lot of individuals that strengthened me and some that are here tonight. One of the individuals is a great man in his own rights and uncountable ways. I mean, he's just a totally fabulous individual. I was on death row, and it was kind of bad, a hard time in my life, and the struggle was...
okay, Reuben.
And, well, it was a hard time during a hard time that I met this man, and my attorney, who has become a brother to me, Lawrence Marshall, went to great extents to bring from Canada this individual, and he came on death row to meet me, a place that he probably thought he would never end up going to. And when he came, he talked to me, and he cried, and he made me learn about life, and he told me that I was not ready to get out of prison, even though I didn't belong there, because psychologically, I was no longer alive. I was surviving. That I had to, and to quote him, open up them damn fountains, let the water pour out, let your emotions show, become alive again. And he strengthened me with them words. Reuben Hurricane Carter, 2 years before I was born, Ruben, started his professional boxing career. He was going to fight for the championship fight and for the title of the world championship boxer. Right before that, he was arrested for a triple murder that he had never committed. He narrowly escaped the death penalty himself. He fought for numerous years, almost two decades, perhaps, as I say, the greatest fight any of us would ever fight. Ruben turned around and always stood fast, as all of us that were innocent did, on his innocence. He gained the support of a lot of individuals, including Bob Dylan, who made a song about him. And Ruben, I don't know really where I'm going with this, except for that this man is so special. He's taken me to his house in Canada to speak with him. And that was the greatest honor I've had in any speaking engagement or being invited into any home.
You're listening to Rolando Cruz, who was let off death row several years ago. And now his prosecutors are on trial. When we come back, you'll hear about that trial. Opening arguments were yesterday. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about the Rolando Cruz case, which has brought the spotlight on the issue of prosecutorial misconduct. A recent series published by the Chicago Tribune revealed that in the past 36 years, close to 400 homicide convictions have been reversed because prosecutors knowingly withheld evidence or did not use evidence that pointed to the person's innocence. And last month, Cook County in the state of Illinois settled a lawsuit filed by four men who spent almost two decades on death row for a crime they did not commit. Right now, though, we're going to talk about the Rolando Cruz case and the trial that is going on this week in DuPage County. Jeffrey Erdanger joins us. He is a Chicago criminal defense attorney who represented Alex Hernandez, co-defendant of Rolando Cruz, who was also sentenced to death in the case and released together with Cruz. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us what's happening this week in the trial? What is the main arguments against the three prosecutors and the four sheriff's deputies?
Opening statements were yesterday, and the case of the prosecution was laid out. The theory of prosecution is that these law enforcement officials conspired over a period of about a decade to falsify evidence, to commit perjury, to obstruct justice, and to commit official misconduct, all in the effort to gain a conviction against Rolando Cruz, my former client Alex Hernandez, and actually another man by the name of Stephen Buckley. These crimes, it's alleged, were committed knowingly and intentionally by people who were charged with discovering the truth and bringing the guilty people to justice. So it's the very beginning of the trial now, and it's expected to last about 6 weeks.
Jeffrey Erdanger, report of the Chicago Tribune earlier this year, sort of previewing the coming trial, says that both in scope and nature, this trial is virtually unparalleled in the history of American jurisprudence. While police and prosecutors occasionally have been indicted for misconduct in the past, no other case has alleged a conspiracy to send a man to death row, and none has alleged that prosecutors perpetuated their deceit for so long. Do you agree with this? And what about this whole issue of prosecutorial misconduct that with you as a criminal defense attorney probably have run across more than once?
Well, the Tribune series was quite remarkable and well-researched. And, yeah, I agree with their conclusions. I think it was based on extensive investigation so far as the uniqueness of this particular prosecution, actually charging prosecutors criminally with their conduct in connection with prosecuting a case. It is unique. On the question of prosecutorial misconduct generally, I mean it's endemic. It's in my mind scandalous, the extent and the depth of it, not just in county jurisdictions, but federal jurisdictions as well. What's probably most remarkable is not that these men are being prosecuted, but that it's the first time that it's happened. It's a reality of life in the criminal justice system. It goes on every day, many times a day, in every courthouse around the country. Conduct which includes knowing perjury by police officers, the knowing withholding of evidence pointing to the innocence of the defendant on trial by the prosecutors. And the problem is exacerbated by see-no-evil judges who just view it as an end justify the means type of circumstance, which they're more than happy to tolerate. If that sounds cynical, I guess it's bred somewhat of 20 years of, as you mentioned, having been exposed to it.
I understand just in this trial that the way the prosecutors and the sheriff's deputies will be defended is to say that it wasn't malicious and it wasn't intended what happened. It might have been as a result of some bad prosecuting, but it wasn't on purpose.
From the remarks I've seen yesterday by the defense attorneys, that appears to be their defense, and perhaps they have evidence to support that, although I'll tell you, having been involved in that case, I represented Cruz's co-defendant at two of his three trials. It strikes me that there were many things going on in this situation, many of them political. Some of the people, the highest-ranking individuals in that particular county who were involved most deeply in this misconduct and these crimes have not only never been charged, but seen their careers advance as a result of their involvement in this case. But, yeah, I mean, they've
in
got...
In fact, one of the prosecutors is now a judge who's been tried.
One of them is a judge, James Ryan, who presided over these miscarriages of justice as DuPage County State's attorney, not only escaped indictment, but went on to become elected as Illinois Attorney General, the state's top legal officer. The judge who presided over these trials, three of them, who was reversed twice by the Illinois Supreme Court, which held that he abused his discretion and denied these men a fair trial, shortly thereafter was elevated to the position of chief judge by his brethren in the DuPage County judiciary. So, go figure.
What about the whole issue that it took a special prosecutor to actually indict these individuals, I guess under the theory that it would be very difficult for prosecutors in any particular office to indict their own. Is this whole issue of the need for special prosecutors at the local levels to uncover this kind of judicial corruption or malfeasance, is that the road to take in many jurisdictions?
I don't see what the alternative is. In situations such as these, the irony here in this area is that the chief judge at the time was, as I mentioned, the man who presided over these scandalous wrongful convictions, was the person who was called upon to appoint a special prosecutor. The judge's name was Edward Kowal, and he, in what was thought to be an audacious maneuver at the time, appointed a man by the name of Bill Kunkel, who was widely known to be a very pro-prosecution, pro-death penalty advocate. And many of us in the defense camp were quite disturbed by this appointment, and actually turned out that Kunkel saw the light, saw that justice was not done, and the only way to cure this was to prosecute these men. It was quite a delightful turn of events.
Jeffrey Erdanger, you and Flint Taylor were attorneys involved with the Ford Heights Four. They were exonerated after being on death row for a 1978 murder that they didn't commit. The Ford Heights Four sued Cook County for compensation, and the county settled last month for $36 million. Flint Taylor, you were involved with that case, and you work against police brutality and torture in cases of people who are put on death row, confessions extracted in those cases. Can you talk about this kind of process that takes place?
Well, with regard to the Ford Heights 4 case, it's very similar to the Cruz case in the sense that evidence was manufactured to convict innocent men at the same time that evidence of who really did it was suppressed by the sheriff's police in this case and also the prosecutors. And the issue of special prosecutor comes up again because we just appeared in front of the chief judge of Cook County yesterday and asked him to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate the misconduct of the sheriff's police, the Cook County Sheriff's Police, and the prosecutors in the Ford Heights case. What we had in the Ford Heights case was four men, young men, about 20 years old, with no criminal background, snatched off the street to satisfy the need to have some scapegoats for a very racially charged crime in the suburbs in 1978, where two young white people were killed by black defendants. And when, in fact, a week later, the police were told who really did it, it was too late because they'd already coerced a witness into naming our men. So they ignored the evidence of who really did it, and for 18 years they covered up the fact of who really did it. When the names of the real people who did it got in the hands of a journalism professor and his students, they went out to the men who really did it and got them. This isn't law enforcement now, but rather students got the real killers to confess. And when they confessed, and when DNA tests were done, it was established without doubt that our men were innocent and that the men who really did it were then convicted 20 years later of the crime that they committed. So that is a horror tale and is why the largest settlement by far in the history of probably the United States with regard to prosecutorial and police misconduct was accomplished in the last month.
Well, Flint Taylor, what about this whole issue, as you mentioned, in these high-profile cases, especially where you have a situation of the murder or a horrendous attack on a white person and the suspects then become black and Latino, the pressure immediately to provide the culprits. What kind of impact does this have, and have you seen as an attorney on the judicial system?
Well, as Jeff knows as well as I, racism is just such a strong factor in the entire criminal justice system. You mentioned that another thing that I've done over the years has been fighting against police torture in Chicago. And believe it or not, we've documented some 65 cases in one area detective division where black suspects were tortured by white detectives and commanding officers. By torture, I mean using electric shock, using plastic bags and typewriter covers over people's heads, and Russian roulette and other forms of torture you hear about in old South Africa and some of the places in Central America. That was a totally racially motivated way to deal with crime. And as I said, it starts with the police. It works through the prosecutors. Believe it or not, the prosecutors who prosecuted the Ford Heights Four, in their particular courtroom, they had a term, and it was called, and please please forgive me, nigger by the pound. And what they did is they took the weights of all the defendants that they convicted, and they added them up. And at various times, they saw who was winning this by-the-pound contest. And they were, in a way, upset when one of our defendants was convicted because he was small and didn't weigh very much. And, I mean, that's how the racism in the grossest form, from police torture through to this kind of game about convicting poor young black men, translates itself in the criminal justice system.
Flint Taylor and Jeffrey Erdanger were also joined on the phone by a senior at the School of Journalism at Northwestern University, because often these cases, what's not reported as much in the corporate media, is how a case is reversed and who gets involved with a campaign to free someone. Well, on his first evening home from death row, people may remember just in the last few months, Anthony Porter, who was freed from an Illinois prison. And Rolando Cruz went to speak with him. Rolando Cruz, who was released several years ago and is the case we're talking about today, for which prosecutors are on trial. And he went to talk to him to help him adjust to life on the outside. Sean Ambrust is one of the students who was involved with investigating his case that led to his exoneration. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sean. It's good to have you with us. Tell us how you do this, because this is not just one case that the journalism school has been involved with.
Well, my professor sort of has a system. He picks four cases each semester. And what we're supposed to do is start with the state's case. And, you know, we look at the trial transcripts, we look at the police reports. And a lot of times when you look at that, in the Anthony Porter case, you see an eyewitness who started off saying, "I didn't see who committed this crime," and ended up saying that he saw Anthony Porter shooting two people in the bleachers. So right away it's a clue that something has happened, and he changed his statements after about 15 hours of interrogation. Then we went to reenact the crime, and we found out it couldn't have happened the way the eyewitness said, because you just couldn't see things from the distances that he said they happened at. And then we interviewed him, and he recanted his testimony when he was presented with the fact that we knew his testimony had to be false. And after you sort of deconstruct the state's case or examine the state's case, then in order to get things reversed, in order to get things to really happen, you sort of have to tell a new story and find out who really committed the crime. And we already had the name of L. Story Simon, the person who did commit the real murder in the case. We had his name from the mother of one of the victims and started pursuing that lead, and it turned out to be true. We interviewed people who knew him, who he confessed to the night of the killings. We then found the real eyewitness who was sitting next to him when he committed the murders, and eventually he confessed to a private investigator who worked with us.
And Sean, this amazing course that that your professor David Protas runs, How did it operate? First of all, what was the title of the course as a journalism course? And also, how did it operate? Was it that you broke up into teams and each pursued a different case, or was the whole class did the whole class choose one of the four cases that he presented to it?
Okay, well, I took it two semesters. The first semester I took it, it was called The Media and Capital Punishment, and it was at the same time as the National Conference on Wrongful Convictions and the Death Penalty. And then last quarter, it was called Investigative Reporting. And what he does, he gets cases through, you know, letters, other sources. Anthony Porter's case came from another death penalty attorney who sort of pointed him in that direction. And he picks four per semester, and everyone picks one case. There are 16 people in the class, and so it ends up to be roughly four students per case. And we just, he's sort of the manager. I mean, he helps us with strategy. He'll occasionally help with interviews when it's really important. But for the most part, we do the work.
Finally, Sean, how did you feel when Anthony Porter was released?
It's sort of weird. I mean, it felt really good that he didn't die and that, you know, we had had a hand in that. But at the same time, it was still just really sad to think that, you know, this man was getting out of prison and he had been in there since I was four. And he hadn't done anything wrong. And it wasn't the system correcting itself. It was outsiders coming in and correcting it. And so it was sort of bittersweet.
Hmm. Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for joining us, and we'll continue to follow the trial of the DuPage Seven. That's three prosecutors and four sheriff's deputies who are charged with railroading a man onto death row, Rolando Cruz, who ultimately served 10 years on death row before being released. Thanks to Sean Ambrust, senior at the School of Journalism at Northwestern, Jeffrey Erdanger, attorney, Chicago criminal defense attorney, and Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at immigrants who died on the border this weekend from exposure. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Officials from the U.S. Border Control and other agencies rescued more than 50 immigrants late Thursday and Friday in and around the Cleveland National Forest, about 40 miles east of San Diego, after they crossed the U.S.-Mexico border. The Border Patrol also discovered the bodies of eight men who died of hypothermia in a snowstorm while they attempted to cross the border. Meanwhile, Mexican authorities working on the other side of the border reported finding an additional two people dead and over 80 people stranded by the cold. As a result of beefed-up border patrols, immigrants and smugglers who've been pushed to more dangerous routes from difficult terrain, critics of U.S. border control practices note that this has resulted in more and more deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border, a terrible human cost. The prevailing policy to seal the border exists against a backdrop of anti-immigrant sentiment and U.S.-imposed economic policy that's favored Mexico's stock market but has hurt poor and working-class Mexicans. We're going to begin the discussion today with Joe Nevins, who is a lecturer of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. Joe just finished his dissertation on and is writing a book on U.S. Border Patrol, particularly Operation Gatekeeper. Can you tell us the history of this program, Joe?
Well, Operation Gatekeeper is a strategic plan of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service that was implemented on October 1st, 1994. And it's an outgrowth of, you know, a steadily increasing border enforcement apparatus along the U.S.-Mexico boundary. But this border apparatus has exploded in the 90s, which is a direct result of the increasing anti-immigrant hysteria in California, but also nationally, that really took off with the beginning of the Clinton administration. As such, Operation Gatekeeper has seen a massive infusion of resources in terms of an increase in number of Border Patrol agents, an increase in the number of fences and walls along the U.S.-Mexico boundary, of the use of infrared telescopes, and of ground sensors that can relay information to Border Patrol officials, letting them know when people are crossing without authorization from Mexico into the United States.
What does this have to do with the people who have died in the last year, over 200 people?
One of the principal objectives of Operation Gatekeeper is to make it more difficult to cross into the United States from Mexico without authorization. And as part of this strategy, what they're trying to do is push people from the heavily urbanized areas of Tijuana, San Diego, further east to more remote areas where it's much more difficult to cross because the terrain is mountainous, because it's desert-like, because there are rivers or canals. And thus, the hope is, at least on the part of U.S. government officials, that this will dissuade people from crossing. What it's done, given the factors that are driving immigration and attracting immigration between the United States and Mexico, given that they're so strong, it simply put people, for the most part, in greater levels of danger. So again, one of the principal objectives is to push people into more arduous terrain, and as a result, these deaths are happening. So, for example, in 1994, right, 23 migrants died in Southern California crossing from Mexico. In 1995, the figure was 52. 1996, 54. 1997, it rose to 89. And last year, it rose to about 140. And these are conservative estimates. There are many people dying that we probably don't know about. There are people that die on the Mexican side of the border as well. Now, not all of these deaths are attributable simply to Operation Gatekeeper. Some of them are a function of changing weather conditions. But we see a steady increase as Operation Gatekeeper and border enforcement more generally has become more intensified, a rising number of deaths. So there's clearly a strong relationship between the two.
I guess immigration control advocates would say, well, whether or not the number of people who've died has gone up, the question is, has immigration gone down, illegal immigration across the border? What's the answer to that?
Well, this is something that's very difficult to measure. But, I mean, given the clandestine nature of so-called illegal or unauthorized immigration, but there seems to be a consensus among people that study this that Border Patrol operations like Gatekeeper have largely had a symbolic effect, if anything, in terms of really slowing down unauthorized immigration from Mexico and Central America in a significant way. The effect appears to be negligible. And in this sense, it makes the continuation of this of these types of operation in the face of all these deaths all the more unacceptable.
What do you think is the answer? Do you think there's a problem with illegal immigration?
I think there's a problem that people feel a need to leave their homes, that they're not able to make an adequate living in their towns or cities of origin in places like Mexico. I think there's a problem when families on either side of the border are not able to unify in a peaceful way, that they have to take great risks to join their brothers and sisters or their children. I think there's a great problem when people are dying trying to pursue what I see and what many people see as a basic human right, that is the right of family reunification, the right to work, the right to provide, you know, the right to seek a better life. Immigration happens for complex socio-political and economic reasons, and we need to understand and address immigration within this context. Clearly, immigration brings benefits to the United States. The California economy would probably fall apart without unauthorized immigrants who provide all sorts of low-wage labor. At the same time, I recognize that immigration, especially for particular localities in places like Southern California, can present real problems in terms of, for example, overburdening local school systems. The question is, how do we address these problems? There are a whole variety of ways we might do so. Immigration control or border enforcement is only one way, and I would argue the most undesirable and least humane way. To the extent that these are socio-political and economic problems, we need to address them in that way. We often hear that we live in a globalized world. This was one of the arguments used to promote NAFTA. And as NAFTA's proponents in the federal government have acknowledged openly in congressional testimony, NAFTA would lead to increased immigration from Mexico into the United States because it would disrupt, especially in the rural areas, traditional modes of existence. I mean, now, how can we recognize, on the one hand, that increasing economic integration is going to lead to greater migration, on the other hand, shut the door to the people who are being, in a sense, pushed out of their traditional communities by these very economic forces? In my mind, it's very hypocritical, because on the one hand, what we're saying is we want the benefits of integration or globalization, but we don't want to accept what's perceived by some, at least, to be the social costs, and that is a changing social and cultural landscape in the United States. Mexico and the United States are increasingly integrated, and we need a new paradigm. We need new policies to deal with this increased integration, and what's taking place on the U.S.-Mexico boundary is totally unacceptable.
Joe Nevins is author of a forthcoming book on Operation Gatekeeper, and he's a lecturer in geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. Juan?
Well, Amy, we're also joined by Roberto Martinez, who's the director of the U.S.-Mexico Border Program of the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome, Roberto.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask you, we have two trends. On the one hand, increasing shutting down of the border by the U.S. Immigration Service. At the same time, you have increasing crises in south of the border, the peso crisis in Mexico, the hurricanes in Honduras and Nicaragua. What's been the result of these two policies or these two problems meeting at the border?
Well, you have here a confluence of a deadly strategy and an increase in law enforcement at the border. While, like Joe mentioned, increasing force of people coming to the north to escape the poverty in Mexico and the devastation in Central America, our South Texas office in Harlingen has documented a dramatic increase in Hondurans and other Central Americans to that area, while here in the San Diego Imperial Valley, we have not seen a dramatic decline in immigrants coming across this border. The Border Patrol, claims that it's Operation Gatekeeper is highly successful. Well, yeah, it has reduced illegal crossing in the San Diego area, but in the San Ysidro area, but it has quadrupled in other areas like the Imperial Valley and Arizona. And that's the reason why, Joe gave a good overview of the dramatic increase in deaths on the border. We have documented now over 385 deaths, including people who have died in accidents, including the Border Patrol agent and three migrants who were killed in a Bronco that overturned and fell 1,200 feet down a canyon, among other things. And people are drowning crossing the All-American Canal in great numbers in the desert and the mountains, and we don't think it's over yet.
Now, these 385 deaths, are they in what period of time?
The Mexican consulate informed us yesterday that we have 22 deaths just this year alone, since January. People are again drowning and crossing the canal and in the mountains, and there's also been several deaths documented on the Mexican side because of the storm. The storm over the Easter weekend, it snowed below the 1,800 foot level and snowed all the way into Tecate, Mexico, where people died there, which is unusual. It's rare that it snows that low. So it was a freak storm, but it caught a lot of people unprepared. I think one of the biggest causes of these deaths is that the people come totally unprepared, dressed in just street clothes, and several of the people who were found dead over the weekend had no shoes. They lost their shoes in the snow. So, and one of the dead was a 15-year-old boy. And of the 385 people who have documented over the last 4 years, many of them were infants and children, from infants to 9, 10-year-olds, teens, many of them husbands and wives. So we're seeing whole families crossing the border.
Roberto, we're also joined by Claudia Smith, who's from California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation. Claudia, could you tell us about the lawsuit that has now been filed relating to some of these issues?
Actually, it's a petition that we filed with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and we've always argued that Operation Gatekeeper is morally unacceptable because it is this deliberate strategy of putting people in mortal harm's way in order to discourage illegal crossings. But in the petition, we have argued that it also violates international law in the sense that we all agree that there's a right to control the border. However, it is not a limitless right. And we do not have a right to maximize the risks. We must minimize the risks. And Operation Gatekeeper is designed to maximize the risks. In fact, there have been, at this point, 32 deaths along the entire California, Baja California border. As of this year, last year, there were 23%, more deaths than the year before. Every year, it has been increasing. And you can see just the soaring nature of these deaths with each new deadly phase of Operation Gatekeeper. The strategic plan of Operation Gatekeeper acknowledged that this pushing people into the east, into the mountains and into the desert, would put them in, quote, unquote, mortal danger. And it also recognized that a number of people would not desist, that they would adjust to these quarters, these very punishing quarters. And I don't think that they anticipated that this many would die. However, when they started dying in very large numbers, beginning in January of 1997, they didn't pull back. In fact, they intensified the strategy. And as each new deadly phase has been implemented, more and more migrants have died. So again, it's a question not of do we have a right or not to control the border. Yes, we do. But we do not have a right to maximize the dangers.
Claudia Smith and Roberto Martinez, we want to get phone numbers from you of your organizations. Roberto, the American Friends Service Committee, where you are?
Area code 619-233-4114.
A little slower.
Area code 619-233-4114.
And Claudia Smith of California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation.
760-433-4085.
One more time.
760-433-4085.
And one last question, and that has to do with what has been the response, particularly in your area on the border and in California, to these deaths?
Well, you know, the Border Patrol always has this worn-out response of putting the entire blame on smugglers. And God knows smugglers are merchants of death very often. It's not a humanitarian service that they provide. It's a very lucrative business, and it is being carried out in a more and more heartless way. But there's a lot of blame to share here. It is the Border Patrol that cannot be absolved from having come up with a strategy of deliberately putting people in mortal harm's way and of not pulling back once these incredible numbers of people started dying.
And Roberto, NAFTA was supposed to improve the situation on the border and in essence create an economic boon for many Mexicans to stay home. What's your sense of what the impact of the NAFTA agreement has been on immigration?
Well, the fact that it's continuing to force a lot of migrant workers, like to our North County here in the farm worker area, agricultural area, and to the Central Valley, tells me that there's no trickle-down theory here in Mexico of NAFTA, but it's not reaching the effects are not benefiting the working poor in the extreme southern part of Mexico, because we've seen a dramatic increase in Mixtecos, Zapotecos, and Guatemalans and other farm workers from the south and from Central America coming north. So we see that it's a failure.
And as Joe Nevin said at the beginning of this segment, in fact, that was predicted and known by those involved with crafting NAFTA. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Roberto Martinez and Claudia Smith. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you missed any part of the show or want to tell friends about us, they can also hear us on the web at any time at www.pacifica.org. Just click on the date of the program you want to hear, and you can hear it. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org, and we'd like to hear your comments, especially on the bombing of Yugoslavia as well as Iraq, and let us know what you're doing in your community. Our number is 212-209-2999. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.